You're not human. That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to this episode of the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I'm D. Allen.
And I'm Donnie B. How are we doing today?
We are doing good. It is episode 11. If you're new here, we are covering the He Who Fights with Monsters book series. And if you're a returning reader, we're going to go over to Donnie for what happened last week.
Yeah, so last time we covered the beginning of what we've come to call the Shab Fight. Jason was in this village checking out this beautiful waterfall. All of a sudden, a Shab came out of it. We got to see a lot of his abilities in action. They were then violently expelled from the waterfall, and more Shabs came out. So now we get to talk about a little bit more of his abilities, some of the ones we didn't see last time. We get to see Jason take his first consumable potion, and we get to see Colin, all of his glory. So I'm really excited about this one.
Yes, sir. Colin in all of his glory. And also, I forgot to mention, we are covering chapters 29 and 30 of the first He Who Fights with Monsters book.
Yes, we are.
My word. All right. So, in the beginning of chapter 29, we're basically picking right up after Jason and Hiram encountered the first Shab. Fought it basically in a tunnel, so close hand-to-hand combat, as it were. And we're picking up right after 17 of those things blasted out of an astral space and out of a waterfall with them as well. And thankfully, most of those died, and there is now four of them that Jason and Hiram need to take care of.
Yes, there are. And we kind of get to see a little separation. So they landed on the banks of this river leading into town. They've got Hiram on one side fighting his Shab. And we got Jason on the other side fighting his Shabs. So it's kind of a cool combination of a team fight, but not a team fight at the same time. We do get to see how Jason does in like open air combat as opposed to confined quarters combat. We don't really get to see a lot of Hiram in this one. He just kind of does what he does. But that's all right, because we're focused on Jason right now.
We are. But really, I think we should be focused on Shab. Because as they kind of describe what the Shab looks like here, and as if you've seen our last episode, you'll know we, yours truly, made a beautiful little Shab. But they basically describe it as such, as a, you know, a shark with beady little crab eyes, crab claws, and legs. And I would really want to know how a creature would even evolve like this.
I mean, yeah, we touched on it a little bit last time, but I really think we should get into it here, you know. I mean, realistically, it's a monster. Monsters do monster things.
I mean, yes, but I'm saying if this were a real creature, how would this evolve? We do know that nature favors crabs, so it is entirely possible that a shark crab could be on its way, evolutionary speaking. We don't know.
Yeah, I think overall it would have to be, you know, a combination of shark being shark and then in the chain of everything else getting legs and moving on to land, it would also evolve crab-like legs for some evolutionary purpose, just based on where it's from, the predators it's facing, the prey it's trying to get to. I can absolutely see the legs that it develops being somewhat crab-like. I think it would really, really depend on environmental factors at that moment that the Shab, the forming Shab, is facing.
I feel, though, it would be more like convergent evolution in that I don't think, as much as I would love to see a shark evolutionarily go through the process of becoming a shab, given that sharks are like some of the oldest creatures in existence, I'm going to guess they're just not cut out to go down the crab line like everyone else.
Well, I mean, you have to take into account the fact that we don't have them here, right? Means that it wasn't beneficial to it at the time. I mean, we look at what's the basic, I guess, reason for crab evolution, right? It's being preyed on, so it develops external armor, the shell.
Mm.
Its main food source and primary defense requires the evolution of claws, right? So having the claws So having the claws serves an evolutionary purpose. So you would have to put a shark in a situation where it would need to develop outer armor because of what it's being preyed upon, and then have the claws be advantageous to self-defense and the food that it's attempting to eat, I would think. So if a shark is put in the same evolutionary position as a crab, I imagine it would evolve similarly to the crab.
It might. However, given that sharks are big and bulky and there's yet to be anything to predate on sharks like that, I sadly don't think a shab is going to happen in our timeline.
Oh, not on Earth, but this is Palamustis, where this is an iron rank creature contending with much stronger, bigger, more powerful creatures in the cosmic sense.
So we touched on this a little bit last time, but I genuinely think that each planet in the astral space sphere, whatever you want to call it, has got to have their own deity of sorts that dictates monster manifestations. And I don't mean the amount of them or anything like that, but I mean specifically, like, okay, mostly I just want to believe that there's some guy out there going, shark, crab, shab. like just some higher deity who's just like playing around with animal Legos and throwing crap together. Because it would explain a lot of the monsters in this series. And I think it would also be really fun for Jason to meet the guy who made shabs.
The guy who made shabs.
Because that's how he would view it. He would...
Sorry, go ahead.
I say that's how he would view it. Like, he would view it like, you know, he's just another guy, and he happens to be the guy who made shabs. Like, I want to see that conversation. Like, why would you make that?
It would 100% start with, dude, what were you smoking? And how do I get some? I think it's entirely possible that this universe has the building blocks, right, for all of the animals that it can inhabit, right? So all of these creatures, there's probably sharks and crabs on Palamustis. We know that they're there on Earth, and it's just a copy of Earth, right? So it's possible that the wild magic coalescing into a monster just creates forms that it knows exist on this planet, and they get mixed and mangled together, and we get shabs, because it's just a form that can exist and function as a monster.
Hmm.
So I think most of the monsters that we see are just a somewhat combination of random elements that already exist within the nature of the world.
Mm.
And the ones that can actually function as monsters are the monsters that we see and later get recorded and are known.
You're taking a lot of the whimsy out of it for me.
I am. I am. I'm not saying you're wrong. Also not saying you're right, but I'm not saying you're wrong.
I'm saying I'm right. Because I just really want to see that conversation. I want to see Jason getting upset at the guy who invented the shab. I think that'd be hilarious. That would be such a good comedic bit.
It would be. Maybe like a prologue or an epilogue in book 14 or 15.
Right? That would be funny.
Write that down. Write that down.
Write that down now. Me? I don't have a pen.
Not you. That's for sure to live.
Oh. Well, either way, I still think it's a fun thought process to go down. Because, I don't know, we see so many other deities that dictate little things. Why would there not be, you know, like, the deity in charge of making the creatures that manifest? Like,
fair point.
I mean, unless it's just a simple, like, the magic on the planet decides, like, for itself.
Sentient magic?
I mean, it's magic. I couldn't imagine it doesn't have some level of sentience or something, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Maybe a bacteria living inside of it?
Possibly.
Like yeast.
Magicteria.
Yo.
Oh. Yo.
I wanna see, like, some microscope action on some magical items, just to see if, like, can you microscopically measure magic in Palamustis?
Interesting. I feel like,
'cause think about it,
Earth would have been on that for a while.
Well,
is there a way to
point.
Distill raw magic into a, like, a tangible, confinable source? That's not a spirit coin?
I was about to be like, Donnie, we had a whole talk about how magic manifests itself into tangible objects like essences, awakening stones, and spirit coins.
Right, but that's all when it manifests into an essence, right? That's a specific magical affinity being physically created. I'm talking about the magic itself before it manifests, just the pure form of magic, the rainbow smoke that we see.
Well, I mean, you might be able to bottle rainbow smoke. However, I think a spirit coin, as it stands, is probably the closest thing to unaligned raw magic. It's just ranked, is all.
That's fair. So hear me out. This is what just popped into my head. So you capture a monster. You put it in a cage with a big funnel on the top of it. Wait for the monster to naturally break down into rainbow smoke. Smoke goes into the funnel, right? Gets passed through tubes with a radiator around it so it condenses. Just like a still. And have it bottled.
So you want to distill rainbow smoke?
Yes, I do. It'd be the most moonshine machine you've ever seen, but I think could be possible. And then you'd be left with just a vial of rainbow magic. Is possible.
I guess it would be monster magic?
Monster magic.
What if at the other end of it, it just condenses into quintessence?
One way to find out. I just imagine the other end of this still, little tiny versions of the monster pop out and go down into this vial.
That would be hilarious.
Mini shabs.
Bruh. Okay.
Just a beaker of mini shabs.
You could sell them by the dozen. You could coat them in chocolate.
No. So much wrong with that.
What if it advances your abilities by eating? It'd be like eating monster cores, but you're just eating condensed shab.
Monster candy.
How was he? How, Shirtaloon? How have you never thought of this? Probably because it's not the best idea. But
or listening to this, thinking these guys are idiots. That's
these
why.
Guys are stupid. Yeah, like
this is why we should like, be given magic on Palamustis. If we were in Jason's position, we'd be moonshining monster candy.
That'd be great. Oh, I want to see that.
Redneck wizards in the world.
Hell yeah. That'd be great. I feel like you would just end up in the blood cult, though. For the outfits alone.
I mean, they're dope, but I don't have to be in the blood cult to get blood cult outfits. You ever heard of eBay? I'll invent eBay,
but that's like,
and that's how I'll get them.
All right. Just for real world comparison, I dare you to go buy a motorcycle jacket on eBay. Just wear it around and see what happens. An MC jacket. You know what I mean.
Oh, a patch jacket. That's what you
patch
want.
Patch jacket. Ah, I don't ride, so I don't know the.
Please hold.
Are you seeing if you could buy one?
It's on the way.
Oh. Well, you let me know how that goes, and I'll remain that that's a bad idea.
We'll find out. If this is my last episode, we'll know what happened.
We will. Now, moving on to the actual reason we're here, fighting the Shabs. I will say, once these things are out of the tunnel, like, when we were in the tunnel, like, I don't know, the overall description of the Shab was kind of goofy, you know, and it's kind of what inspired my goofy little Shab. But when they describe them fighting one out in the open with their speed on land, like, I can see how this is a frightening monster.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, it is. It does have a major disadvantage not being able to go forwards and backwards as effectively. But I can absolutely see if one's coming at you sideways, it could be a real menace.
Before we get into Shab movement speed, the battle here kind of plays out that Colin gets thrown out at the first Shab, completely covered, and essentially just annihilates it with the, you know, his leech-like abilities, getting in between the plates and all that good stuff. Solid writing, solid gross-outness. and Jason, although he has some powers, he is still limited in his abilities. His power set's pretty slow right now. And he does yet again something that we see him do time and time again, sacrifice his own well-being to take care of the problem, whatever it may be. He does it all the way through the series, but this is a good small time example of it, because he notices that his power set is slow, so he's like, I need to get in and do damage now. Can't get around the pinchers, so I'm going to sacrifice my left arm. And he just puts up his left arm to block the pinchers so he can get in close and stab. Which, like, first off, the ball's on that guy.
Yeah. No, he was full on prepared for his temporarily solid skin through the shell potion to act as a shield, basically, and protect him through this pincher, which, to be fair, it does. Not as effectively as
that's
I'm
right.
assuming he would have hoped for, but, you know, his skin was hard enough to allow him this moment. But still, like, the ability to get past your own survival instincts and be able to go, well, catch it so that I can make this move, insane.
I know, like, could you imagine having to make that choice, like, well, it's either sack the arm or goodbye the rest of me. So
yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. And so and he takes this one out pretty quickly too. He gets a few hits in under the plating and gets that poison in, and on top of inexorable doom and punish, you know, this everything starts to stack. Bleeding is stacking, sin is stacking, all that good stuff is stacking. Mm-hmm. And he decides to run backwards to get away from the crab. And I call bullshit.
Care to elaborate?
Because I have seen crabs in real fucking life. They move in a zigzag pattern. So if you're trying to get away from them, they're going to just and get their way to you. Yeah, but the crab is not thinking.
Jason's not a crab or a shab or a shark or any of the above. He can just backpedal.
I'm aware that Jason can backpedal. I'm just saying. I guess when I read through it in my mind, I was like, bullshit. I guess it would really depend on how many steps, how far back he needs to get before he casts his next spell. But if he's like trying to outpace the shab, I say no way, because those things are way faster. Even just a regular crab is way faster than a human. So something this size is going to be speedy, and it's going to know that it's going to zigzag and get you. So,
I mean, maybe, but you also have to understand this particular shab is suffering from necrotic damage and increasing necrotic damage and poison. And so it's
and it did fall out of a waterfall. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not in the best shape of his life at all. And now it's being killed from the inside out. I don't think a shab is going to be fully focused. I don't think anything other than a seasoned combat artist, really, anybody trained to fight, is going to be like, fight through the pain and outpace and stay in position. Like, this is all strategy that the shab's not contesting with at the moment. It's slowly dying, and it doesn't know why. So I'm sure it's pretty locked in place.
Well, fine. Yeah, okay. No, that's a good point. I don't know. I was just imagining when I have encountered crabs in real life, and those things are fast and scary. So I could only imagine one the size of a shark.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if it wanted to and it was in a good condition and healthy, yeah, maybe backpedaling wouldn't do it. But I think this one's injured enough that it's not in the mindset to chase him down.
All right. I'll give you that one. It's always funny. I always try to find these points of contention, and you always have some logical reason why. No, you know, maybe.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you even believe in it or if you're just good at playing devil's advocate.
Yes.
Ooh. All right. So when this endeavor starts, the quest is for 4 shabs. He has just dispatched 2, theoretically leaving 2. However, all the while, Hiram off screen has been fighting one of the shabs.
Yes, he has.
We very sadly do not get to see his battle, and I'm a little sad about that, because we never really get to see Hiram fight.
No.
But after Hiram kills one of the shabs, the quest number for Jason goes down. Like, that shab did not count. It actually removes 1 shab from his total quest count in the shabs. And I found that odd. Why would... what is effectively a team effort decrease the total amount, like the max amount of shabs in his quest.
So I think it's, I've got a couple of theories on this. First one being the his interface, and then later on the ability to become a party interface, right? Is recognizing that even though they're working together, they're not working as a party, as it were.
That's a good point.
So the total idea here, the entirety of the quest is to eliminate the four shabs that are endangering the village. But when Hiram takes out his, it's not Jason's fight. So Jason only has to worry about the other three, because the fourth one is a non-issue now. It's a non-starter. He didn't kill it. It's not his fight. It doesn't matter. So the village is protected. The objective, the overall objective of the quest is completed, just not by Jason. So there's three shabs now endangering the village, and that is his fight. So when he kills the first one, it goes to one out of four, and then one out of three when Hiram kills his. Because Jason got credit for the first kill. The second kill wasn't his, so it goes down to three. And in his fight, he still got two left on his side that he needs to deal with for this quest. So I think it's a combination of them not being an official party recognized by the interface, and you know, the overall goal versus the fight that Jason's currently in. That's what I imagine is happening.
That makes sense, because initially I was like, this is, it's kind of weird. Like, I can't even explain why it's weird.
Yeah, well, I think we see this a lot in video games where it does count the completion aspect versus the amount necessary for completion. So anytime you see a ratio like that in a video game, it gives you the very beginning number, and then it just ticks off for computer basis. It ticks off so it can keep track of, you know, what the overall goal is versus what's been accomplished already. But I do believe that in a real world sense, you know, and a lot of other video games should be incorporating this, right? Like your job, your quest is to defeat this number of enemies. If that number of enemies goes down at all, and it wasn't because of you, whether it was, for lack of a better term, NPC interference or environmental factors, or the overall number of them went down not by your hand, it should be the total number goes down, right? Because your job is to fight your fight. And if it's not your fight, you shouldn't get credit for it. And I think that's where the looting comes in later. We'll revisit this when we get to looting, because I think it's all tied in.
On that thought, though, like, I wonder if it actually affected his quest rewards, though. Like, do you think he gets a lesser reward for the overall amount going down?
I wouldn't think so, because the quest is rewarding the completion of a goal. And although the risk level went down and the challenge or the difficulty went down, I don't believe the goal changed. And so the completion of the goal grants the reward, not how hard you had to work for the goal. You know?
That's fair.
It would be like the quest that he gets, like, for his adventure contracts. The reward is the same as the reward for the contract. So I feel like, you know, if somebody else came along and took care of the contract before Jason, his quest would go away because he didn't actually do anything, so he wouldn't get rewarded from the quest, but he could still collect the reward from the Adventure Society, right? So he didn't complete the goal, he doesn't get the reward. But if he comes in and he has help completing the goal, he would still get the same reward.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair, yeah. I like that. So it's really just more of a number keeping situation than anything.
Yeah. So the way the magic works with his interface, I think the quest in general is telling him what he needs to do, and it keeps track of his progress towards doing that. I don't think it's as video game like as you're going to get a reward, but it's going to be based on the challenges or anything. It's just telling him, hey, keep in mind, you've got to do this. I'm going to keep track and tell you when it's safe. And that goes all the way into the Destiny magic and everything that we can get into if you want to. But I think overall it's just, hey, here's your goal. And I'm going to helpfully keep track of how you're doing with it.
As it stands, I always want to hear your thoughts on magic, brother.
I think realistically it's just that, right? So his, I mean, the interface is his invocation, for lack of a better term, of the Destiny magic, kind of just keeping him on this path until the quest system goes away, right? And the fact that it's keeping track of the numbers isn't as important as the fact that it's actually there doing a job. So how many he kills and how many he has to kill isn't as important as the fact that he has to protect the village, and this is just the system's way of identifying that.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
And speaking of the magic, getting back to this fight here, so when Jason backs off, we get to see him for the first time in combat really cast Feast of Blood, which is the spell that he uses, and basically it's just it's a life drain. So if a living target has a bleeding condition, which he's just given it, then he can siphon off a little bit of health from that enemy. And this is a really good ability, in general, I would say, like just a nice heal ability for in combat. We see how powerful it gets much later on. And as he ranks up, right, it's going to be a massive boon for him. This is the first time we actually get to see in combat recovery that really synergizes with his power set. And, you know, as an affliction skirmisher, this is going to be really big hit or miss, because everything he does has to be perfectly timed. Especially now that he doesn't have all of his abilities, he's got to do things in order and in a specific way, and being able to take a step back and then regain health, regain mana, and then go back in for it is very powerful.
Yeah, that's cool. And I mean, even though with his powers, like on the whole, they're not a fast power set. But they are a very effective power set, because he was able to take out, you know, effectively way more than he was realistically capable of doing solely based on this slow churn power set. And obviously, you know, a life drain ability is going to be crucial to having a slow power set. So
it is, for sure.
Yeah, so it's kind of cool to see the synergy of everything working out for him, especially because since he hasn't had the time to really train with all of this, it oddly enough gives him enough time to really think and plan what he's going to do as everything is stacking on itself, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh, 100%, and especially in the beginnings of a fight, he is very vulnerable while he's stacking afflictions, so the ability to step back, you know, he's going to have to step back and get away eventually just to let the thing die, but to be able to heal while he's doing that, you know, gives him the ability to take on another enemy or get back in the fight if he needs to without risking even more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, realistically, you can't be an affliction specialist without, you know, a broad power set with these kind of, you know, status move draining abilities. Like I said, still fully believe that Jason is just a Venusaur.
Oh, yeah. Well, we get to see other affliction specialists that have to hide behind a wall of defenders and healers, you know, because right. of the slow burn and the vulnerability. And being able to do that for yourself is what makes him one of the most powerful, I think, that we see in the series, you know, despite his unreasonable godlike ability to have luck and the impossible right. things that he does just for fun. Like, I think this is one of his biggest assets, the ability to heal when, so he doesn't need to carry a healer with him per se, whereas other affliction specialists might have to, is going to be huge for him.
Right. What's much later in the series, like book 11 or 12 even, I think, which one is the town where they're all obsessed with everyone being like a pure typing, as it were, like you only...
That's Rimuras.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we
yeah. see... And it's funny because you see exactly that. You see, like, sure, you can do a lot in a very specific category, but you can't do what Jason can do, which is slow and fast, you know, because eventually his power set moves him up to the ability to, like, all right, I can move slow and take out crowds, or I can move fast and take out a big guy, you know?
Yeah. No, we will absolutely get into, you know, the whole argument between the Rimuras fighting style and the Vitesse fighting styles, and, you know, have that entire argument when we get there, because that is going to be a fun episode to do. We do have quite a few books to get through before we get there, but yeah, we're going to revisit that in full force when it happens.
Absolutely. Now, one last bit of magic that happens before this fight ends is the Benny Hill chase between the leech pile and the Shab.
Yes.
That is comedy magic right there, because, I mean, I'm just imagining both of these little, you know, seemingly pseudo-fast, but still kind of slow creatures. Well, a leech pile is probably not fast, but all-consuming in a way. But it's just chasing a Shab in circles, and they're locked in a power loop.
They are. Oh, and I know everybody's gone through this section specifically multiple times, like we all did. But just to set the scene for you, this is one of my favorite things, because Jason's in combat with the second Shab, notices that Colin's done. He's got it covered. He's out. He looks over and goes, hey, see if you can't catch that one next. You know, like, go start the third one. I'll be there in a sec. And, you know, Jason backs off. He heals up. He's waiting for the second Shab to die. And it is standing right in between him and Colin and the third Shab. And, you know, we see the reason that they're going in circles is because the Shab's fast enough to get away, but unwilling to actually turn away from Colin. And Colin's just not fast enough yeah. to catch it. So Colin yeah. is going at it while it's sidestepping, and so it happens to go in a circle while Colin's trying to catch it, also letting him go in a circle. And just the idea of standing there waiting for your fight to conclude while watching this happen. And then he comes up with a line. He goes, when I said see if you can't catch it, I didn't mean don't catch it. I'm like, we know that's not what's happening, but at the same time, that kind of looks like what's happening.
That's a banger of a line, though.
It is.
When I said, see if you can't catch it, I didn't mean don't catch it.
I love that so much. And he's just standing there, forced to watch this ridiculous scene while his Shab is screaming in pain, dying in front of him. And he's just sitting there. I just right. imagine him sitting there like this, like, I don't even know anymore. Right?
Like, and it's so funny too, because, like, I feel like a real animal, if they were, you know, against a recognized threat, it could lock them into a loop like that. And now I'm like if it wasn't morally wrong, I would love to, like, throw a crab in with a bunch of leeches and see if they would Do it. However, given how crabs work, he might just eat the leeches, so...
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is specifically a magic-based scenario that has to occur. But it is absolutely hysterical to picture. And we, And after Shab number two dies, you know, Jason kind of has to sit there and corral the leeches into the crab, you know, and it's a whole other ridiculous display. Like, he's just like, here, I got it. Come on. You got it. Oh, and just trying to help the leech pile while the Shab is like, I don't want to die.
I don't want to die, but I'm too afraid to run. And yeah. The ironic part is if the Shab would have just run, it would have been fine.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. It could have just gotten away, and then they'd have to go track it down later. But at the same time, fear's a powerful thing.
Yes, indeed, it is a powerful thing. Anyway, Jason dispatches this last one, successfully ending the Shab fight and the quest. He gets the rewards for the quest and everything.
Yes, he does.
And as he's going, he sees he's going back to meet Hiram, and he sees Hiram's Shab, and he goes to loot it, and his interface is like, you cannot, you do not have permission to loot this. And I, once again, because I don't pay attention to details, don't ever recall another instance of loot consent being a thing.
So it is a thing a few times. I think this is one of the few times we actually see him try and loot something and it telling him not to. It happens a couple of times, but after this, he kind of understands the loot consent thing. A lot of looting happens in the future when he's in a team and the things were killed by his team. So being in the same party is automatic loot consent. So, like, with Neil's looting ability, he can also loot anything that Jason kills that's on the same field when they're on the same team. But there are a few times where he asks permission to loot something, or, you know, it's kind of like a one-off line, like, you mind if I loot? Or, hey, I need your permission to loot. It's always a present thing, but it's never, like, a big deal like this. This is one of those situations where comes in as a teaching moment. So this is the first time that Jason learns about it. So it's the first time we learn about it. And then it's just a constant.
Okay, that makes sense. So anyway, though, he does get the permission to loot. And I find it funny that he goes through all of this and essentially just ends up with, like, some low count stuff. Like, low coin count, low whatever. Does he get the essence from the quest reward or from the loot?
I believe it comes from the loot. Yeah, so the water essence comes from this particular Shab being looted.
Okay. Okay, so then, honestly, him giving the essence to Hiram makes sense because Hiram did it. And I love Hiram's resistance to being given this essence because we discussed a little bit before that, like, you know, an essence would probably cost, you know, in our dollars, like at least $20,000-$30,000.
Yeah.
You know, like it's an entire car. So this scenario, like the hesitancy that we see from Hiram in accepting the essence, it would literally be like some guy you just met, you help him move his couch and he's like, cool man, here's my brand new Corolla, all yours. Right. Be like, bro, I can't take that. That's insane.
Yeah. But I feel like, this is a good example of, you know, something we see throughout the series, something that makes Jason stand out throughout the entire series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to Hiram, Jason gives him this water essence, right? And Hiram is seeing it as a gift from one person to another person. And he's like, this is way too much. Like you said, all I did is help you move a couch, you know? And the value of that essence to Hyrim is monetary, and it's so mm-hmm. much more valuable than he would ever need. But to Jason, you know, aside from the fact that the water essence came from Hyrim Shab, you know, Jason sees the value of what Hyrim did as an adventurer's job, you know, and mm-hmm. he's attempting to compensate Hyrim, for lack of a better term, with adventurer pay, right? He's like, you did what an adventurer did, you get what an adventurer would get. You know, his value is based on the job that was performed, not the monetary standing of that item in this society. And that's something that stands out way harder in the rest of the series. You know, value to Jason is based on what you did and how you did it versus, you know, what somebody should get paid or what somebody deserves to have.
Right. And I think that, like, I agree with that, because Jason, his value system is not set in the material world. There are many occasions where, you know, he is given opportunity for material gains, or he's offered material things, and he either gives them away, turns them away, doesn't care, because his values are based in people and their accomplishments and their growth, as opposed to anything so trivial as, you know, material things, money, be it whatever.
Yeah.
And the line that he delivers Hyrim here is so good, because Hyrim's like, dude, I can't accept that. He's like, the monster came out of there. The village is over there. You stood right here in between them. Like, you earned this. What are you talking about? You don't deserve this. Like,
yeah.
You just stood in the path of danger for your entire town. Like, that is worth, yeah, like, and realistically, you know, I think if he would have pulled four complete essences out of that shab, I still think Jason would have been like, there you go, bro.
Yeah.
All yours. Because again, it has nothing to do with money. And, I mean, we've talked about it before in a previous episode, that Jason's relationship with money is exactly just, it's a tool. It's nothing more than that. It's just a tool. He is not interested in material gains. He is interested in personal growth.
And this is the biggest lesson that I think Jason can teach all of us, right? You know, to Hyrim, being an adventurer means you're in the adventure society, you have the badge. To Jason, being an adventurer means you stand in the way of those who can't stand for themselves. You know, it's a it's a perfect example of, you know, does the man make the creed, or does the creed make the man? You know, to Jason, what right. you do as an adventurer makes you an adventurer, not the badge that you carry or the people that you know. So in Jason's eyes, Hyrim is an adventurer. You know, Hyrim is a hero. He is the protector, because he did the thing that adventurers do.
Yeah, 100%. And I love it, because I think Hyrim is described as a bit older, right? Like,
yeah.
Like he's not really been an adventurer. He's just been like a village guy. Has like an essence or two. I don't even think he has a full set, right?
No, he has the might essence.
That's right.
Yeah. Which is why he's in charge of guarding the waterfalls, because he's one of the only ones with any essences at all.
Right. And we see that, you know, we take it for granted, even as a reader, that everyone in this world has got to be, you know, fully essenced out. Everyone's a crazy wizard, but that's not the case. Like, normal people still just live their day-to-day lives here. And, you know, someone with just one or two essences still is not that far above just a normal person. They just have some abilities that help them do their normal things.
Right.
But, you know, that would be the equivalent of, you know, getting a bachelor's degree or something. You know, like, you have a bachelor's degree, you don't continue your education, you get the degree, and, you know, just live your life rocking and rolling versus someone, you know, who goes and gets a, you know, a full PhD in the same subject you got your bachelor's in. Like, you know, that's the difference between an adventurer and just, you know, a regular person with, you know, with some ability, as it were.
Right.
And it's cool to see that there is such a similarity, even in a world like this, that, you know, not everybody's crazy wizard man, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the thing, right? Jason has his full set of essences, but they're brand new, you know, and he doesn't know how to use them. He doesn't know how to fight. He's not even a part of the Adventure Society, but the people around him, you know, just kind of assume he's traveling with adventurers. He's got all of his essences. He must be an adventurer. He must be better than, you know, all of us. He must be
right.
That level, you know, just because he has these things.
And I think it's a good example of, yet again, some of this, like, philosophical stuff that Sherloon throws in here. Once again, just pointing out the things that matter. It's, you know, it's the people and the experiences that matter, because, you know, their perception of Jason being already all geared up, good to go, is pretty much just based on a financial idea that, oh, he's had the money to have all of his essences. At least that's how someone like Hiram would see it, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
And so, and possibly to someone like Hiram, someone like Jason is another class of person, you know, it's a whole other thing. And that's why Jason is so charming to everybody, because he has all of that and continues so on, even as he does grow into that role. He still stays the common man, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a big part of, you know, the Nietzsche philosophy that we've been looking into as well. You know, mm-hmm. It's about being the best version of yourself that you can be, not the best version of what somebody else tells you you can be. You know?
Right, like, not Superman in the sense of da-da-da-da, Superman, but just a super man, like superhuman. Like, he's a human.
He's an outworlder.
Well, he's an outworlder. Oh, you know what I mean. But he's a man, but, you know, he still gains all of this stuff, but it doesn't, it gets close, but it doesn't ever truly shake his humanity. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. No, his entire personality is all about, I'm better than I was yesterday, not I'm better than you are today. And that's mm-hmm. why so many 100%. People love him, you know, no matter where he goes, because he looks at the common person who sees him as this rich, successful, powerful adventurer, and he looks at them and says, hey, I can learn something from you. Will you teach me? You know, and it's the humility and the humanity that people attach and latch onto and identify him with. And that's something that other adventurers, like even with Farah that we see, who's just a bronze ranker from Vitesse, you know, can even see, like, why are you so popular with everybody? Why is everybody, you know, talking about you? How are you friends with everybody? You know, because she grew up in this, you're an adventurer, you're better. You're rich, you're better, mm-hmm. not, you know, I still want to be me.
Right. And that is a huge thing in our own society right now, even. And really, ever since society's been a concept, it's, oh, I'm rich, therefore I'm better, you know? And it's, you know, in some ways you might be, but in none of those ways are because of your financial position.
I think the biggest takeaway that we can achieve in life in general is the idea that everybody you meet is better than you in some way, right? Everybody right. you meet will be better at you at something, you know, will know something you don't, will be superior to you in their own way, and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's not because I do this, or because I know this, or because I have this, I'm better than everybody put together. You know, it's
right.
And that's something that Jason has that we could all learn from.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that, you know, on that idea of the Nietzsche philosophy, this is another one of those ding, ding, ding moments that Schertelun is landing here.
Yeah. And the subtle act of giving an essence, Schertelun has taught us about life.
I love that. Oh, but... So now that the Shab fight is done,
yes,
and the moral lessons have been learned, they head back into town to essentially go be lifted on the shoulders of everyone because they are now the town heroes. And it seems as though Jason gets a little more recognition than Hiram. However, Jason did do, you know, 4/5 of the work.
Well, I'd put it at 75%. It was pretty 50-50 on the first one, and then it was 3-1.
That's true. I was giving Jason full credit for the first one.
He couldn't have done what he did without Hiram.
Absolutely. And so now that they're back in the village, starts, in chapter 30 is essentially, one of our nice little slice of life / interlude chapters where the team is catching up on what's been happening. We're getting a little narrative, and the great leech pile that we have unceremoniously have just been calling by his name, Colin, the entire time.
Yeah.
This is the point that Colin gets his name. And in the beginning of the chapter, he's having a little conversation with the leech. And I found it kind of funny because you can kind of reverse the leech's answers depending on... like if they are really communicating properly or not. You can flip his answers and it make it seem like Colin is being like, no, I don't want a name.
Yes. We can we read that conversation through the book legally?
I think if we snippet it, I think if we
All right. So we're absolutely for you guys at home, we're going to present this to you. We're going to do a little call in response from the book. So you guys can see both versions of the conversation, and then we'll let you decide which is better. So Colin moves to the left. Jason says, so that's a yes, unless you don't have it, and then it's a no. Which is all confusing. Jason decides that he gets it. Jason says, he goes, is that fine by you?
Colin looks left for yes.
Jason says, do you have a name?
No.
No name? Would you like me to give you one?
Yes.
That's the end of the conversation. Hold on, I got this. So that's pretty much how it went. Now let's reverse it.
All right.
Like we tend to do. All right. So we start off with the implementation of the system. So left for yes, right for no. You have that?
No.
All right. I'm just going to assume you've got that. Is that okay?
No.
Great. Do you have a name?
Yes.
No name. Would you like me to give you one?
No.
That's good. Jason proceeds to give him a name. That is absolutely ridiculous when you reverse it.
That is ridiculous. So in reversing it, it literally could seem as though he already has a name and does not want to be given a name. And Jason is just like, yeah, whatever. I do think, though, that given what we learn later on about how Colin was brought here, I do think that Colin actually was answering as intended. Like, he was, like, the system was working correctly.
Yes.
Because Colin is actually just a newborn baby Apocalypse Beast, and he don't have a name.
He do not have a name. And I feel like Colin, as a being, would be smart enough halfway through this conversation, if he didn't have the system down, based on Jason's responses, he'd be mm-hmm. like, okay, we're doing it the other way, and then adapt immediately.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah. So I feel like even if he didn't have the system down, he would grasp it pretty immediately. But also,
right,
he needs a name.
He does need a name. And Colin is the name that is given for no reason.
Oh, there's a very important reason. We just haven't got there yet. It's the same reason we get Gordon later on. So the reason, this is a couple chapters later, the reason that Jason names his familiar Colin is because he's this amazing, incredible, super scary apocalypse beast of destruction. And with a name like Colin, people are not going to be immediately afraid of him. Right?
So that's right.
Yeah, he's like, well, I want a nice friendly name so that people don't automatically assume he's just going to end the world for fun. And doesn't assume that I'm responsible for ending the world for fun. And so it's a little
thing.
It immediately breaks down any guards that people had up, because you see this creature come out called Colin, and your first reaction is no longer, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose my face. It's Colin?
Colin? Like, what? Could you imagine if Colin then did end the world for fun, and the world just was killed by Colin?
Then the astral beings will refer to the end of Palamustis as death by Colin for all eternity, and it still doesn't sound that bad.
Right? Like, aw.
How did the world end?
He's a good boy.
Colin.
Colin.
Same response. Colin?
Colin? Like, yeah, you know.
But here's the real question. The most important question with regards to this apocalypse beast. With a name like Colin, you think he'd be able to phone it in? If he never comes back, he'll be able to call in sick.
I turned my camera back on too early.
Yes, you did.
Funny, I was actually thinking of a call-in joke too, but I didn't get there. You got there before I could.
Gotta be quicker than that.
However, though, when he's given the name, though, despite our joking that he could not be doing it, I do think that already at this point,
I just got the joke.
What?
Oh my god. For context, I've read through this series 4 times now. I just got the joke.
Which one?
When he's in danger, call in the apocalypse beast. When in doubt, call in the apocalypse beast.
I mean, it works. Do you think that is the intended joke? Is that line ever been delivered?
No, I don't think so. Not like that. Oh my god. on.
I guess it would.
That has to. There is no way Shirtaloon didn't see that coming and do that intentionally.
I mean, but I would feel like Gordon would also work that way if that were the case.
Gordon, the Avatar of Destruction? Avatar of Death? He's an Avatar of Doom. When in doubt, Gordon, the Avatar of Doom. It doesn't work as well. Call in the Apocalypse Beast!
I mean, I do like that, though. It does work.
Holy!
But what I was going to say, though, is... Go ahead. Now that we're thoroughly off track, I do think, though, that Colin already really trusts Jason, because even though Jason doesn't have all the skill in the world, he sees that Jason is a good thinker and moves well in battle, and Colin lives for battle. So Colin lives to destroy things, so if he sees that this guy really is down to destroy things, I think Colin's like, yeah, man, you want to give me a name? Whatever name, man. It works.
Oh, yeah. No, I think this is the beginnings of their full bond as familiar and summoner, and it only grows deeper from there, because we do see those moments of let's destroy everything that pair nicely with the moments of time out, let's take a step back, don't eat that. And it's a fun play, a dance, if you will, that they do back and forth. And I think there's a lot of respect going on between the two of them.
There is. Now, for some context that we walked over, by the way, after the battle, where he decided to go was to the inn in this village that they were staying at. And that's actually where he's giving this name. And I say this... because the mayor of the town and like other important people in the town are here, and he is just talking to everybody like first name basis. And we've talked about it a few times, but he really does have a baffling popularity. And I genuinely think, like I said, we've talked about it, but I think it's his normalcy that makes him so popular, because, you know, as we've seen, both in a financial, like monetary sense, but also social status sense, adventurers are just, you know, they're elevated above the normal people. So to have someone with all of these abilities and crazy stuff, but still be able to just talk about what you made for dinner.
Yeah,
I think that's what gains him that immense popularity, like right off the bat. Like he is in this random town. The rest of the team hasn't even gotten to know anybody. They don't even bother, because they're just like, oh, these are just, you know, NPCs basically. But Jason's like, hey, yo, these are people too.
So for context, we're back in the village. We're in the inn that they're staying at, in the outside patio garden type area. And, you know, the team comes back from their mission, reconnects with Jason, and Rufus is slamming reed doors, of course. Mission didn't go well. Gary and Farrah sit down with Jason in the courtyard to have some fruit punch, and... You know, this is where Farrah makes the comment of Jason's popularity. You know, she's like, why is everybody talking about you in town? Like, everybody's talking about you. And, you know, Gary's interested in the fruit punch and the familiar, of course. And so this is where we really get context on what the team was doing while Jason was shabbing it up.
Yeah, that's right. And so they were trying to go after the guy that set them up. They found out he was hiding in the desert, only to find out that Anissa has since dispatched him, and he's no longer alive.
Yeah. Thus the slamming of the reed doors.
Yeah. Which, like, Hello. Excuse me? Why would you do that? Like, I was about to say, has none of them seen, like, CSI? And, well, no, they haven't.
No, they haven't.
They haven't. And it's fun. It's kind of funny, too, because Jason is, like, pointing out that, like, yo, I think he even says, like, she's on the shonk, which, for context, what you had the context for that. What was the actual translation of that?
That's unreliable or deviously dishonest. Basically, like, I don't know, it would be an equivalent. What would you call somebody that's not vulgar? That's like this.
That's not vulgar?
Yeah, vulgar.
Oh, got you. What? Sketchy, I guess, would be art. Yeah. On the shonk is a way cooler word.
Yes, it is.
Or turn of phrase. And it's in my vocabulary now.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, she's being sketchy. She's being suspicious. She's being not quite all there up front, you know.
She's on the shonk. But it's funny because all the Palamustians, is that the right word? All of the people of Palamustis here, they obviously don't think about, you know, potential crime in the same way that, like, someone from Earth would be, just because, you know, we have a deeper understanding of, well, or rather, we have a different understanding of law proceedings. And due to that understanding, Jason can, like, piece together things because our law system works in a certain way that theirs doesn't, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's, like, piecing together a case, like, well, hold on. She didn't get locked up in the cages. She, somehow miraculously escaped her captors and then killed the witness who knew what was going on. How are you guys not seeing that? Farrah even literally says, sounds kind of thin. Like, what do you mean it sounds thin, bro? Like,
right. And this is a heavily debated topic among the community as well. Just because of this incident, right? And I'll give you, Jason's got a very strong circumstantial case, right? I will tell you my side of it right now. Like, yes, a lot of this is suspicious, but I honestly, I do not think that this argument is going the way that it actually would have happened, right? So, like, they were, you look, that didn't make any sense. Let me lay it out, right? So Anissa was in the cages with them. That was enough for Farrah and Gary and Rufus. You know, she got captured too. She's obviously on our side. The fact that she was removed from the ritual was a combination of Jason being present and Derek wanting to try an elf. So she was taken away.
Oh, yeah.
Not because she was in the know, but because she was no longer needed. You know, and we went over Cressida's mm-hmm. decision to sacrifice Jason being the reason this whole thing kicks off. But if Jason hadn't shown up, I don't think they would have, you know, just not used her in the ritual, right? Why would you sacrifice one of your people when you've got a willing person right there, an unwilling person right there? And most importantly, the Blood Cult doesn't know about the Builder stuff. They don't know about, you know, Landomir's connection with the Builder Cult. You know, none of this happening has anything to do with the Blood Cult. So why would they care about her connections with the Builder Cult when they can just summon an apocalypse beast?
The only comment I have on that is it not shown somewhere in there that the Purity Church had a hand in setting up the Apocalypse Beast ritual?
Maybe. Right, so it's because, we come back to it after
that arc. Right. And so that's my only thought is there may have been some tenuous connection between her involvement and the Blood Cult. Now, not to say, I do think Cressida would have had no qualms just throwing her in, even if she was the person who set it up, because, I mean, she literally, you know, wanted to eat her own son. I was going to say she did, but she didn't have the time to. She died.
Yes, but the way this all came about, right, it's like dropping an instruction manual in a somewhat inobvious place, right? So like the Builder Cult didn't show up to the Vayne Estate, be like, hey, here's how to summon an Apocalypse Beast, go nuts, you know, we'll send you some sacrifices. Right. It was very much like behind the scenes type stuff that is happening. It's like the Reaper Cult type of assassination style of information giving. So they weren't like, right, hey, the builders want us to do this, we're gonna do this. It was a, hey, we just figured out how to do this, we should do this.
Yeah, okay. That's a good point. That is a good point. I don't know. But either way, I think at the same time though, like I don't see, you know, if there was some later involvement, I don't see why Cressida wouldn't have just thrown like Daryl or Dougal in, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And to be fair, on the whole, this entire conversation is basically just a side order of foreshadowing with their fruit punch.
Yeah.
So full respect there. But also, I really don't think anything he's saying while alluding to future events has any merit here. Right?
Right. Yeah, and you're right. And at the end of the day, Fair is a bit right too. Like, if you tried to present this case to a judge, they'd be like, well, she was on your team. You guys were looking for that guy. She helped you take out that guy. You didn't get the answers you wanted, but technically speaking, she was acting in the interest of the team, just not in the way that the team was interested.
Yeah. And that's the biggest thing, right? Like, the reason that Rufus is so mad about here is because he feels responsible, you know? He's very hard on himself to succeed. You know, we find out a little bit about the Remora Academy and Vitesse and the background that they came from. And, you know, he failed and he wanted to find out why he failed. And Anissa took that from him. So he's obviously upset. Like, he, in his mind, how could I possibly lead my team better if I don't have the opportunity to learn from what I did wrong? And Anissa's only interest is looking out for herself and what she wants. You know, Anissa took away his ability to find out why he failed, and that was just unacceptable to him.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, I totally remember this. You were talking about Vitesse and Rufus, and it just reminded me of my weekly lingo check-in here. So Jason makes a comment saying, oh, there's a language where Vitesse means speed. And I was like, okay, that's got to be a real reference. So I looked it up, and in French, it can mean speed or velocity, something along those lines, which is the antithesis to Vitesse and Palamustis being laid back and leisurely. So and it's funny, I don't even know what to say about that.
It's just irony incarnate.
Yeah, It is just irony. But I love it. It's funny. I love even just a small joke like that. Like, here's the super leisurely town. What's its name? Speed. Fast. Yes. But anyway, back on Anissa. Like, through all these interactions, like, he's got Colin just chilling on his shoulder. And she is like, what is that thing? We need to burn it and him with it. Like, what are we doing? Even going as far as to try and snatch it off his shoulder, which Gary comes in like a bro, just like, nope, get out of there.
That's not happening.
But, like, if anything, that alone, like this person who's supposed to be on your team is disrespecting the guy who just saved the town and even says, like, why is everyone treating him like he's the town hero?
Because he's the town hero.
Like, I'm sorry, ma'am. He's literally that. He's him.
No, and that's probably one of the biggest ironies that I find with Anissa too. And she's like, he's tainted, he's impure, he needs to die and burn. We need to cleanse this place of his being. And Rufus is like, yeah, we're not doing that. You don't get a say, you're off the team. And this is when Anissa, racist as all hell, comes in. She's like, humans, you're all filth. Which, reading back, is probably the funniest thing ever, because way later we get introduced to the Order of Redeeming Light with Sophie's mom, mm-hmm. who's like the most radical purity offshoot, and their entire goal is to make everybody human, because anything but human is unpure and unclean, and they all need to be human.
And that's so right.
It's like, I really wanted to see Anissa meet the Order of Redeeming Light and just to see what would happen. She's that like, humans are unpure, funny. And they're like, well, we're purity, so we know, and you're not human. You're a fucking elf. Maybe you're the one that's unpure.
Maybe you're the one that's unpure. Well, and then that could start, like, purity faction wars, because, like, yes. where's the elf purity church, you know what I mean? Like, if it's...
Yeah.
If we compare it to real world, everyone with that, like, mentality always thinks that their group is the best, so she might genuinely believe, like, elves are the best, the rest of you need to die. Maybe Anissa will come back. Wait, is Anissa dead? I don't recall.
She's full dead. Full dead. This one goes out to all of you Dungeon Crawler Carl fans out there. I know you haven't read the books yet.
No.
But I just read through them all, and in the books, there is a whole event known as Faction Wars. And for those of you out there that are fans of the series like I am, I want you to imagine the Faction Wars from the series, but all of the purity cults.
That would be funny. I have no context, but I still think it would be funny.
Trust me, it would be funny. if you're a Crawler fan out there, go ahead and drop a comment. Let us know which faction you think purity would shine through.
Hell yeah. So that actually about wraps it up for Northeast Quarry Village number 4. In fact, the last thing that Jason does before they really decide to gear up and leave town is procure himself a knife that does not poison himself when he cuts himself with it to release Colin.
Very big important. He also gets big himself important. A little notebook to record recipes in. And I think these two purchases define Jason.
Elaborate.
Well, you've got the combat side of him who needs to call out Colin. That's the knife, right? And in doing so, learning from his previous mistakes, not deciding to poison himself, which I do believe is a good idea in a combat situation, because you can buff your resistance immediately.
By poisoning yourself? Yeah,
every time he poisons himself, and we know from the dagger, he's going to resist that poison, he gains instance of resistance. Yeah, so a poison dagger to release Colin, I feel like would be a good idea, but hey, that's just me. But then you got the you know, goofy humanitarian side of him that bought a cookbook because he still, in his heart of hearts, wants to pursue his passion of cooking in a new place. So I think we get the citizen and the military side of Jason in these two purchases, and those two are going to come together and make him who he is.
I love that. That was really nice.
Thank you.
All right. Well, in the next episode, they are finally leaving Northeast Quarry Village number 4 and headed out on their way, or at least tangentially towards Greenstone.
Yes, they are.
And we are going to slowly start seeing Jason building up to being the badass Jason that we all know and love. And it's going to be really fun. Soon enough, we're going to be getting to the Adventure Society and all that fun stuff. So we just want to thank you guys for sticking along with us. And there's plenty more to come where this came from.
Yes, there is. If you're new to the channel, go watch the rest of the episodes, I guess. If you're returning, thanks for staying with us. You can check us out on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, X, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Absolutely. And if you have no context for what He Who Fights With Monsters is, and you made it this far in the video, we appreciate it. But go read the book.
Yeah, go read the books. Go all of them. 2-3 times. Come back. Tell us what you think.
Absolutely. All right. Well, till next time, I've been D. Allen.
And I've been Donnie B. Remember, fight monsters.
But don't become one.